14th of March, 96. We are interviewing Mark Perlman for the National Council of Jewish Women. I'm Howard Braun, and Ruth Saul.
And this is Mark Perlman, testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
This is Ruth Saul. Mark, we left off last time. You were telling us about your World War II experiences and the disappointments you felt dealing with the Italian prisoners. Do you have anything to add to that?
Well, I don't recall exactly where I was, but I found being with Italian prisoners a bit demoralizing. I rather like them. Indeed, I looked up one of them many years later in Italy, and I thought that he could hardly forget me, but he had. And he suggested that we have a drink, and then when he saw me, he remembered me.
Oh, the drink helped his memory.
Yes, it was when he took me home for a very good dinner.
I
always remember him because he was a rather senior official in the Fiat company, and he didn't know how to drive.
He had chauffeurs.
He had chauffeurs, of course. His name was Peyron, the captain, P-E-Y-R-O-N. And he must have been some kind of a shirt-tail relative of the critical family. In any event, after that, I was in... I went to a War Department-level school, which fortuitously... was at the time of the Battle of the Bulge, and it was for that reason that I was not shipped overseas, because they cleaned out the camps of everybody who looked reasonably able, they all went off to fight in the horrible experience of the 107th Division, which was the one that was cut up at the Battle of the Bulge. But there I was at a War Department school, to my amazement, on the faculty was a captain who had been the captain, who had been a lieutenant, had been in my basic training outfit. In my basic training unit, I was the first one designated for Officer Kennedy's school, but he put the kibosh on that. Again, when I was at the War Department school in Lexington, Virginia, at Washington and Lee University, again, I was selected for Officer Kennedy's school. Again, he put the kibosh on it. And I said to him, his name was Russell Babcock, and he was a sort of a protege of a woman by the name of Lillian Hirschfeld, who I think was a social worker in Chicago. And Lillian Hirschfeld had been a great admirer of my father's work and apparently knew him. And I said to him, when he put the kibosh on the second time, what have you got against me? Why do you always put the kibosh on? And he said, have you ever looked at your service record? I never thought I could, so I said, no. He said, well, you'll see what I have against you. I see in your service record that you're very, very smart. I think the word he used was brilliant. Very cooperative and willing, but you are just inept, physically inept, and you won't last 20 minutes in combat. And it struck me at the time that this was a very nasty thing to do, but perhaps the reason I was still around is because he did it. Later on, I got to thinking about what he was saying, and what he said was the following. What I think he meant was the following. You don't think the way other people think. You get to your conclusions by a different route. And people don't trust your reasoning, because when you are asked to explain why you do something, you're very likely to come up with a very interesting answer, but nobody follows your reasoning process. The Army can use such people as colonels. They cannot use such people as second lieutenants. And this always struck me as a very insightful point. At the time that he told it to me in Lexington, Virginia, I was steaming mad, better mad than dead, I suppose, is the point. In any event, I went back to a camp in California where I eventually became the sergeant major of the camp,
And when the war was over, I was demobilized, as the British say, and went back to the University of Wisconsin, where I arrived in mid-semester, but my father, with whom I had taken some courses during the war, and I'll come back to that in a minute, my father suggested that he ask two of his colleagues to give me special reading courses. And that is how I would, that is how it came about that I would spend 3 hours a week with Merle Curti, the Pulitzer Prize historian, specializing in American cultural history, and John Gauss, G-A-U-S, probably the preeminent American political scientist of the time. It was very good tuition, and I learned a great deal. Gauss took me out for lunch after I submitted my first paper to him, and although he was much too refined a man to use the language I'm about to use, but he said, you're bullshitting, will never pass me. I suggest that you redo the paper on John Dewey's The Public and Its Problems and do it right. Start off by outlining the book for me. So I recall that I typed something like 20 pages of outline of the book. And it was the first time I had ever done a job in what the French call explication de texte, E-X-P-L-I-C-A-T-I-O-N-D-E-T-E-X-T-E. And it was a very good experience. Well, I went back to the University of Wisconsin. Kadushin was no longer at the Hillel Foundation. He had been replaced by Theodore Gordon, a reform rabbi, and much more attuned to most undergraduate student life. Rabbi Gordon had little or no intellectual pretensions. And I found Hillel Foundation much more pallid than it had been before. Now, during this period, I remember one or two things which are worth noting. Robert La Follette, the son of the original Senator La Follette, and who had been a senator from Wisconsin for the better part of 23 years, was running for re-election. He was challenged by Joseph McCarthy. This was in the Republican primary. I was very active in the La Follette campaign in the sense that I went around and got signatures and went around and talked to people. La Follette lost the nomination to McCarthy, which was not surprising. However, he ran as an independent. But a professor at the University of Wisconsin, a political scientist who should have known better, Howard McMurray, ran as a Democratic candidate. And many of us wanted McMurray to withdraw because we were sure that McCarthy would win. But McMurray, one of those Democrats who are more impressed with principle than facts, chose not to withdraw, and the follow-up was defeated. In any event, I stayed at the University of Wisconsin for that year. My father had wanted me to assist him because he had discovered that he had a rather serious heart condition and became quite flustered about his inability or his fear that he would be unable to meet classes. I had wanted extra money, and I had taken a course in the summer in statistical methodology, and I had done quite well in it. And I suggested to the instructor, or the professor, that he hire me as an undergraduate instructor. These things were rarely done, but I had done very well in the course, and so he offered me the position. My father then, having discovered that I had gotten an undergraduate assistantship, then went to the dean and suggested to him that I be allowed to be his assistant. The dean, an eminent medieval intellectual historian by the name of George Clark, C-L-A-R-K-E, Sellery, S-E-L-L-E-R-Y, had been rather dubious about my father's sponsorship of me. And when he remarked to my father that my father had given me a course in the Army for which I had gotten an A, he wondered how much work I had actually done. My father was prepared for him, and it turned out that in that course I had had to read six books and write 6 long essays, each essay being typed between 20 and 30 pages. Sellery read the essays and overcame whatever reluctance he had in these arrangements, and so that is how I became my father's assistant. From an intellectual standpoint, it was a marvelous experience. From a social standpoint, it was a disaster. It was a disaster because it was a prime assistantship in the department, and the other graduate students, quite understandably, did not incorporate me into the group. I did not sit in what was then called the graduate assistant's bullpen. I had my separate office in my father's office, and the result was some degree of social awkwardness. In any event, at the end of August 1947, I had gotten a master's degree as well as a baccalaureate degree. I believe the baccalaureate degree was dated in June, and the master's
what
degree...
What year was this?
This was 1947. And I had accepted an instructorship at Princeton University. I had applied to quite a few schools, and had been offered assistantships at Harvard and at Berkeley. I had also been offered a Sterling Fellowship at Yale. While I was at Wisconsin, I had taken some work in the law school and found the work very difficult. I had sat in on a course on torts, and everybody kept telling me that there was a logic to torts. Later, I realized that if there is a logic to torts, one of the tests of being a judge is to discover that logic. Nobody else can. Rules just changed at different periods in time. However, I was under the impression that one should be able to understand that sort of thing. In addition, I had taken a course with Willard Hurst, H-U-R-S-T, who is a major figure in legal history. This was a course of legislation, and I learned a tremendous amount. There was only one examination in the course at the end of the term, and I remember writing a very disorganized examination. I not only had footnotes to my text, but as I recall, I actually had a footnote to the footnote, which was an effort to try to argue something through. In any case, there had been a tradition at Wisconsin that if you were a non-lawyer and you took Hurst's course, he would up your grade one full grade, because most economic students got C's. And since they were graduate students, they didn't want C, so they were given a B. Well, I apparently got a B-plus on the examination, and he was really quite unwilling to raise the grade to an A, so I got a B-plus, and that frightened me. So when Yale offered me a Sterling Fellowship with a promise that I would get both a degree in law and a degree in economics, I was frightened. And it was very foolish of me, because that was one of the major mistakes I had made in my academic career. In any event, I took the instructorship at Princeton on the grounds that I would spend some time sitting in classes and learning economic theory, which I thought was very poorly taught at Wisconsin. And off to Princeton I went. Now, in my period in Princeton was a very interesting one. My brother moved from Rahway, New Jersey, where he had been living, to Princeton. And although we saw each other several times a week, our relationship had never been a particularly amicable one. He was a rather silent fellow, and I was, certainly by his standards, extraordinarily verbose. He was a person who handled people very well, in the sense that he was...
Mark's brother, what was his name?
David.
Yeah.
He handled people very well, in the sense that he was very likable. He was clever in the way of handling people. I digress, but this is the best story about him. When he died quite young, he died at the age of 60, right shortly before his 60th birthday. He had a malignancy. And the death was a long and traumatic business for both of us. But in any case, shortly after he died, one of his colleagues said to me, this was probably right at the time of the funeral. It is such a pity that David died before his birthday. This was in 1980, because he only had 14 birthdays in his life. And I said, oh, and he said, yes. He said, we always had a party for him on February 29th when it was his birthday. So I said nothing. His birthday happened to be on February 6th. But he knew how to make himself into a character, and he was not averse to altering the calendar a bit if that would work. Well, in any case, I was at Princeton. I did, within 2 weeks of arriving in Princeton, I had decided that I didn't care for Princeton very much. For one thing, they were not at all impressed with the kind of economics that I was impressed with. Specifically, they were not impressed with the sociological approach which my father preached, and I was not particularly impressed with what I thought was their lack of creativity. But secondly, Princeton at that time was a very proper community in the sense that it was very Anglo. It has strong sense of Anglophilia, a great love of the English way of doing things. I had gone to school in England. I probably was always an Anglophile, but I had very little worship of the high tea aspects of the British culture. My version of British culture was probably much more tied up with Dickens and 19th century novels than it was with the upper class aspirations which dominated Princeton. In any event, one of my close friends at Princeton was Harvey Leibenstein, Leibenstein. Leibenstein and I had dinner, I think, a couple of times in the first month we were there. And by the end of the dinner, I had become convinced that Harvey had the touch of the genius. He was brilliant. He suffered from a horrendous stutter, which, as my father also suffered from a stutter, I understood the advantages of a stutter, namely, nobody ever interrupts anyone who stutters. You listen carefully. And so one of the reasons why I could discover that Harvey was such a bleeding genius was because I had to listen to him. But he was brilliant. Well, I announced to Harvey, after I had been there about, maybe 2 months, that I was not going to stay at Princeton. I was going to go to Columbia, where I had also been offered an assistantship. Harvey said to me that he was kind of disappointed in Columbia, too, in Princeton, too. And I said, how's that? He said, well, you know, I was teaching at the Illinois Institute of Technology before I came here. And I reckon that when I came to Princeton, I would really meet people who were in the big tent. He said, however, when I see the people here, they're no better than the people I knew at IIT. And I said, well, who are the people at IIT? He said, somebody you've never heard of, a couple of fellows you've never heard of, Herb Simon and Franco Modigliani, Modigliani. Both of them have subsequently got Nobel Prizes, Nobel Awards in economics. Mm-hmm. But in any case, the year there was an interesting one. Now, here we get back to the subject of my Jewish interests. The Kadushans, who are now living in New York, suggested that perhaps I would be interested in going to the Park Avenue Synagogue, where Milton Steinberg...
Wait a minute. Did you get yourself to New York yet?
Yes, I was in Princeton.
That's not New York.
Yes, well, Princeton is half an hour or an hour from New York.
Okay.
They suggested that I would be interested in going to the Park Avenue Synagogue, and so they asked Milton Steinberg to invite me for the high holidays. He did, and I went. And I was overwhelmed by Steinberg. He was the leading Reconstructionist rabbi of the time. It's true that Mordecai Kaplan's son-in-law was also a major figure, but Steinberg was the orator. It was the first time I'd been to a synagogue where there was a first-rate cantor. He was Nathan Putterman, P-U-T-T-E-R-M-A-N. As I recall, Putterman used an organ, which I thought made the service more melodic. Steinberg's sermons were the first sermons I had ever heard which were first-class sermons. The Steinbergs invited me over for a meal one time, and I found him a very warm person. His boys were young and very bright. I sensed that there was some tension between him and his wife, but that was not particularly noticeable, except that I remember remarking on that to the Kedushans. And Max Kedushin said, well, that's a major problem. In any event, I started going to Park Avenue Synagogue for the quality of the religious service. And this was the first time, as I recall, that I ever found the synagogue an extraordinarily interesting place. I liked the music, but most of all, I was overwhelmed by the flow of words that came out of Steinberg. And they weren't just words. There was substance there.
I read his books.
Now, during this period, I had also read Joshua Loth Liebman, L-I-E-B-M-A-N, who was a reform rabbi in Boston. And his work really tried to make, to explain the Jewish religious practice consistent with psychological wisdom. I might mention that on one of these trips to New York, I ran into a girl who had been at Wisconsin, Leah Ruth Pearlman, not spelled the way I spell our name, P-E-A-R-L-M-A-N. Lee Ruth, I ran into Lee Ruth at Penn Station, and she was extraordinarily glad to see me. She had a great admiration for my father, and I think a bit of it slopped over for me. Anyway, she was with Naomi Waxman, N-A-O-M-I-W-A-X-M-A-N. Naomi Waxman had been a student at Wisconsin, and my father had always commented to me that there were two brilliant, prototypically attractive Jewish students he had had. One was Edith Handler, H-A-N-D-L-E-R, who was my parents' age and who married Simon Kuznets. And the other was a student much later on, was Naomi Waxman. And so now that I met Naomi Waxman, I suggested that we go out for dinner sometime eventually.
What year was this, Mark?
And this was in the autumn of 1947. This started a long, very intentional courtship. Now, I might mention parenthetically, there were before her other girls, and during the courtship, since Naomi was a particularly reluctant partner for any kind of courtship, there were other girls in the meantime, too, but my recollection is that the courtship got rather serious by December of 1948. Eventually, we got married in 1953. In any event, I want to pursue this Jewish topic a bit. People of my generation had a very unique experience in Jewish history. Many of us were not terribly interested in synagogal attendance or the synagogal aspects of Judaism. We lived in essentially an anti-Semitic Christian society, and we knew we were Jews. We may not have wanted to be Jews, but there wasn't much choice. I found at Princeton some people were what I think one of my friends called washes. W-A-S-H, obviously play on wasp. A wash, W-A-S-H, is a white Anglo-Saxon Hebrew. These people tried very hard to downplay what they thought were their Jewish cultural qualities. However, the great problem in 1946 and 47 was principally what to do with the remaining refugees of the European Jewish community, refugees who were, for the most part, in displaced person camps, DP camps. And their plight was awful. Not only had they had horrible experiences, but no country in the world wanted them. Now, my background in terms of Zionism was quite intellectual. My father and Weizmann knew each other, and I've seen correspondence between them in which Weizmann had twitted my father for not wanting to move to Palestine. Weizmann's comment was, "You are a non-traveling Zionist," was his phrase, non-traveling Zionist. My father, however, had overcome the anti-Zionism of his Bundist, B-U-N-D-I-S-T, background, and by 1946, he was fiercely Zionistic. As he had several admirers and friends in the British cabinet, a cabinet which was dominated by Ernest Bevin, he would write to them and asking for better treatment of the Palestinian Jewish community. In particular, I remember he wrote a very passionate letter to I think it's Jim or James Griffith, G-R-I-F-F-E-T-H, which he asked him to show to Ernest Bevin. Now, Ernest Bevin was quite an admirer of my father, but they were not friends. My father's friendship was with Griffith, and I think that, as I recall, Griffith wrote back and said that he had shown this letter both to Clement Attlee, who was the Prime Minister, and Ernest Bevin. With Attlee, my father expected to have very little clout, because Attlee was not a trade union figure. But Ernest Bevin was a major trade union figure, was an articulate admirer of my father's work in labor unionism, and he hoped to have some influence. Well, it was a forlorn hope in any case, and that was the background. When I went off to Princeton, the Jewish community, this was in the autumn of 1947, the Jewish community was beginning to get its act together. Prior to 1946-47, the dominant voices in the Jewish community were essentially German Jews. There were a few exceptions, but the leadership was French, the traditional German Jewish leadership of the American Jewish community. Brandeis, of course, had been displaced by Weizmann in the Zionist movement, but it was the Brandeises and the wealthy bankers in New York who had largely sponsored Jewish organizations. Their failure to handle the refugee problem led to a revolt, really, in the American Jewish community, and people who were not of that social group, I stress their German orientation, but the important thing was not that they were German, but they were socially a cohesive group. I believe it's the Harmony Club in New York City, which was their club. That group found itself being pushed aside by a group of World War II veterans who felt that they could stand up and make demands on the American government. That prior to this period, the German Jewish community leadership thought that backdoor negotiations were the preferred method for changing American policy. Not so with this new group. Now, in Princeton, the local drive was headed by Albert Einstein. And Livenstein and I and a few other Jewish fellows would go down to what later became the United Jewish Appeal office. I remember it was Wednesday or Thursday afternoons when Einstein was likely to be there dictating letters, and we would stuff envelopes or do whatever would make us, whatever would be helpful. Our principal purpose was not to simply to help on stuffing envelopes, but to hear what the great man had to say. And that is how I got to know Einstein a little bit. During our conversations one time, he asked me if I'd ever met John von Neumann, N-E-U-M-A-M-M. And I said, no. And he said, well, you really ought to meet him. He said, he's probably the greatest mathematician since Newton. Perhaps he's even greater. Now, it was also clear that he didn't care for von Neumann. Von Neumann was came from a very wealthy Hungarian and Jewish family, a Budapest family. And Einstein was quite left-wing in his views, and von Neumann was extremely right-wing, very anti-Stalinist in his views. In any case, with this bit of information, I remember somebody asked Einstein, I'm sure I didn't have the chutzpah, what made a man a great mathematician? And Einstein said, well, a man is a great mathematician if he observes a phenomenon and then develops a mathematics to explain the phenomenon. And just as Newton observed gravity, presumably because an apple fell, von Neumann had observed how his father, who was a very successful investment banker, how his father